A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sim. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 49. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about Artemis 81. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
On an alien planet, there is a battle between good and evil, and a battle that somehow is also involving Earth, and the fight perhaps to save the soul or the life of a writer. And many other ideas are involved, because this is a very complex show. It was a 3-hour BBC television movie from 1981.
That's right. It was broadcast on the 29th of December 1981 by the BBC. A slightly odd time to be shown it. It was in that sort of strange period between the Christmas holiday and the New Year, where I think TV shows can perhaps flounder or suffer slightly. And it was only broadcast once by the BBC, although it was sold abroad, but I'm afraid I don't think we have much idea of which other countries it was shown in, and then it was never repeated, and it sort of disappeared for 25 years. And as we've talked about before on British Invaders, often these programs that disappear start to gain a bit of a reputation and a bit of a cult status, and that's certainly what's happened with Artemis 81. It had this, as Brian's already said, this famously sort of obscure and somewhat confusing plot and somewhat confusing structure to the whole thing. But it's an interesting show. It's certainly got science fiction themes, which we're going to go on to talk about as we try and fathom what was going on. And it's another interesting show for us on British Invaders, because I think it's the first one, Brian, that's new to both of us.
That's right. This is the first time we're directly taking a suggestion from a listener. So thank you, Mike, also known as Jarek. We're covering this and we'll be having fun with it, I'm sure.
Yeah, because usually I think one or other of us has seen the show or saw the show when it first came out. So here we are. It was new to both of us and quite an interesting experience, as we'll get to. And as we go through, you'll find, I think, perhaps slightly more question marks than in our normal reviews. And certainly there'll be a lot of uses of the word strange as we go along.
That's right. It is very layered and has lots of references and literary allusions and homage to Alfred Hitchcock's films and to Scandinavian impressionist film and even to things like organ music. So there is a lot in this. It's very complex. It's certainly something that is not simple or straightforward to understand.
Okay, so let's see if we can get into the sort of early part of the story and some of the basics. Already we're going to be into some tricky areas, but as you said, it starts on an alien world, which we can tell is alien because there appears to be two suns in the sky.
With unusual colours too.
Exactly, that's right. They're strangely coloured and a strangely coloured sky. And across this landscape, we see two characters who we find out are brothers, and they appear to be arguing sort of over a strange statue or talking to this statue, and they're calling the statue mother. And we get the impression that this statue may wake up, and if the statue wakes up, then it something bad seems likely to happen. And quite early on, we get the impression that one of the brothers doesn't want the statue to wake and the other one does, and we seem to be away from there, off from there.
Yes, we're introduced very early with these light versus dark ideas of the two aliens being light and dark, good and evil. Lots of metaphor about things like that in this. And the individual they're arguing over is like this black stone, sort of falling apart old statue. And there is some comment about that this person, who they refer to as mother, would cause untold destruction if awoken. And we then cut to modern day Earth, where we see a small statue that bears a striking resemblance to the one from the alien planet. And it is in fact stolen from a Danish museum and smuggled onto a North Sea ferry going to England. It's at this point, when you see the statue, that they first mention the name Magog, and we're given the idea that this statue and the alien statue maybe this mythological figure, Magog, for destruction. And as we see, as things go on, people who come in contact with the statue or come near the statue seem to come to rather unpleasant ends. There seems to be a situation where some of them actually get a hold of one piece of the statue and are sort of taken over and guided somewhere. Others who are on this North Sea ferry meet an even grimmer fate.
Strange and mysterious stuff going on. And we meet another character who's a writer, who's going to be one of the central characters. And he's a writer about paranormal matters. And he starts to investigate some of these strange goings on, and in particular a series of suicides which may be linked. So he starts off looking into those. Meanwhile, there's a music student, a young female music student, who may or may not be the writer's girlfriend. It's a bit unclear as to what their relationship is. And she's met a very strange character, this rather mysterious and reclusive musician who plays the organ. And she's sort of, I suppose, fascinated by him, by his sort of legendary status and so on. So there's all sorts of strange characters introduced to us quite early on and quite quickly to begin with.
Yes, when we see the North Sea ferry, we get the music student, we get the organist, and a whole series of minor characters that play into things, but we are introduced to a lot of people very quickly, and it's through the music student that we're introduced to the writer that is her friend, who gradually starts to investigate things and starts to look at all these pieces and put them together. And his work on that may be what will come to save the world and perhaps defeat these forces of darkness. It's a lot of unclear things being pulled together at the beginning.
So let's try and sort through some of the mystery by identifying these characters and running through them quickly. We've got the writer who goes by the name of Gideon Harlax, and he was played by Huel Bennett. And he's sort of very much set up, as I say, as he's a writer on the paranormal, and his books are very successful and very popular. And I sort of got the impression that he was set up as a British version of Stephen King. There was that sort of feel to his character. He spends an awful lot of time investigating sort of strange matters, but he also spends an awful lot of time just sitting, pondering over his typewriter and thinking about all this stuff and trying to put some of the pieces of this mystery together.
They introduced the idea very early that Gideon wrote lots of things about paranormal events in his fiction, but really didn't believe any of it himself, and was very much a person who was on the straight and narrow and needed everything to be rigorously explained and was very emotionally detached from everything else around him. And through the story, he grows and changes in certain ways.
Yes, as you say at the start, he's a skeptic and he's very detached and he's very organized. And there's rather lengthy shots of him cleaning and maintaining his typewriter, which seem very strange. But they seem to sort of tell us something about his character, I guess. And then there's Gwen Meredith. She's the music student, played by a theatre actress called Dinah Stab. And as I've suggested, she seems to be interested in Gideon on a romantic basis, but it's not clear early on whether or not that's reciprocated.
I can take his hallucination and match it up with something actual from my coincidence file. It's the pattern I've been looking for. What a narrative scheme. Real lines of force. I've only four suicidal acts so far. He has five fragments. But four is neater.
Gwen?
Why are you telling me this?
Why? But you gave me this story, love. You involved me with the man.
I'll owe the book to you. I'll dedicate the book to
I gave you something else. Much you valued that.
What?
There's a few characters who are interested in Gideon Harlax, and Gwen is one of them. But she's also interested in this other mysterious and reclusive figure.
And that figure is Albrecht von Drachenfels.
What a great name.
Yes. They mention the idea that perhaps von Drachenfels is not his real name, that this is a deliberately imposing name. And he is, of course, this famous organist who is now mostly living as a recluse, performing from time to time, and is very secret of he is married, but he has this wife who is very ill and very close to being in a coma, it seems. And much of what he does rotates around that. And it is fairly clear at the beginning that he understands more about what's going on than we do, and more about what's going on than the other characters do as well. Von Drachenfels was played by Dan O'Herlihy. And then we start getting into the even more mysterious characters, the more mystical ones. And we have Helith, played by Sting. Yes, that's Sting. Who is perhaps an angel or perhaps an alien. And he is one of the characters we see in this strange, unusual opening sequence. And he gradually goes from being completely removed from the action to being involved and very much trying to make sure things are okay and that the terrible destruction is not unleashed.
And of course, along with him, with Helith, we have his opposite number, his brother, Azrael, played by Roland Curran. And he is pretty clearly the bad guy. And we can tell he's the bad guy because he wears black the whole time and he's got weird, scary eyes. He, even when he comes to Earth, he wears black suits. And in fact, his suits become more and more sort of gothic horror as we move towards the end of the film. So he's quite clearly, he's the appears to be the force of evil. Although what he wants with the planet Earth and the people on it is not entirely clear, and we have to try and work that out as we go along. But he sort of completes the set of the main characters who we'll be coming back to throughout the film.
Yes. I think on the whole, the casting that they did with those main actors was actually quite good. They made some somewhat unexpected choices. They went a little far away from the standard people you might expect. Particularly with people like Sting, who had not done very much acting at that point. I think that added to the unusual and different qualities of this in a positive way.
Yeah, I mean, those last three we've mentioned, I think particularly, as you say, Sting looks the part, and Roland Curran playing his brother and the bad guy certainly looks the villainous part. And then Dan O'Herlihy, with his sort of like flowing long grey hair and his cloak, his scarf, is very much the sort of eccentric musician, although he could also fit in as a sort of mad scientist character. He would even, you know, you could almost see him as Doctor Who, really. You could almost see him as the Doctor from Doctor Who.
Now, getting into some of the production aspects of this, we'll get into more of the story later. Getting into the production aspects, it was originally intended as a production between the BBC and a Danish television company, but the company from Denmark pulled out somewhere during the production. I'm not exactly sure when. But despite the fact that the Danish company pulled out, the fact that there was a Danish connection had a huge impact on this show, right from the script, where the idea of using an organist was because there is such a tradition of organ compositions from Denmark. Many aspects of the style and the story were drawing from Danish sources because of that. And of course, part of it takes place in Denmark, and there is a North Sea ferry from Denmark to England involved. So the idea of Denmark and England, even though it wasn't a co-production in the end, it still was a very prominent idea in this.
Okay. And Artemis 81 was written by a chap called David Rudkin. And this is very much was a one writer's project. I think the person who's most got their fingerprints all over this is David Rudkin, who'd written some previous TV plays, although he actually started out writing film dialogue. And interestingly enough, he wrote some additional dialogue for the Truffaut film of the Ray Bradbury book Fahrenheit 451, which I found quite interesting. So he'd done some odd TV shows, and then he came up with this idea, or in fact, I think quite a number of ideas, which he was going to work into Artemis 81.
That's right. It was commissioned by the producer, David Rose, who was producing a lot of TV plays. This was generally what he did before leaving the BBC to help set up a new British television station, Channel 4, which I believe started not too long after Artemis 81 aired.
Yeah, I think Channel 4 was 1982. And as you say, he had to leave the production. I think by when they'd finished the filming, he then had to leave the production because he obviously went to go and start his work at Channel 4. It was directed by Alistair Reed, who's a real TV regular director. He'd previously directed The Tales of the Unexpected, The Roald Dahl short stories on TV. And he would later, after this, he would go on to direct the first ever Inspector Morse. And quite controversially, he directed a television show called Traffic, with a K at the end, which was about, amongst other things, the drug trade, which went on to become a very successful Hollywood movie. It was adapted into a Hollywood movie called Traffic, with a C at the end.
And originally, they were talking about doing Artemis 81 as a two-part story or a three-part story, so it would be serialized. And I think the writer and director, Rudkin and Reed, thought that this was a good approach, and it was actually written with potential cliffhangers there. But in the end, because of scheduling and what have you, they dropped that idea and went to a single 3-hour teleplay, one broadcast, which happened in late December 1981. Rudkin and Reed were both heavily influenced by the films of Alfred Hitchcock, as we mentioned, and also Scandinavian Impressionist film, including Ingmar Bergman and some, of course, Danish directors as well. And imagery from those things became an important part of it. Direct references became part of it. And references in terms of homage and style and things that were done directly in the script and the story also were a part of it. The idea of being referential to these other types of work was fairly central to this right from the beginning, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, if you can imagine a film written by Ingmar Bergman, directed by Hitchcock, set on a North Sea ferry and an alien planet, and you're starting to get a flavor of Artemis 81. It's a weird combination.
Strangely enough, that sounds about right.
We'll mention a couple of other production notes. The music, which we'll talk about later on, was mostly by Dave Greenslade. There was also some specific organ music written, obviously, for the von Drachenfels character, and in particular for the climax of the film. And that was written by a reasonably well-known television composer called Gordon Cross. And then the filming of the show, quite a lot of location work. I mean, they went to all these places, and in particular, they shoot on the ferry, and I suspect they shot in Denmark, and they shot in several locations around England and Wales. And if there was if there's much sets building going on, it's not that I could notice. Everything looks pretty solid and pretty real.
Yes, it was generally based on that feel. It was more or less produced like a movie, as you would with a theatrical movie, but with a much smaller budget. And it was entirely shot on film, which unfortunately the film has not been preserved all that well, so it looks a little bit worn and grainy on the DVD because of that. But they had quite an elaborate production given the kind of budget they were working with. They had a limited amount of time to shoot on this North Sea ferry, which meant various problems and things with the weather and that kind of thing. But they pulled it off, where you had the characters meeting each other and different characters being introduced and things that we could see below decks on the car deck of the ferry, and a bunch of things going on that they did actually shoot on this ferry. So that was something that was used to pretty good effect.
Yeah, it was. I mean, they worked quite well in the end. I remember when we talked about a series called The Nightmare Man, we were talking about how for that series they had to produce fog because it was needed for the plot. But in Artemis 81, I suspect they had rather too much fog when they were on board the ferry, which obviously caused them a few problems, but they dealt with it reasonably well.
Yes, they did have a lot of fog in that sequence, but it made it seem like that type of ferry crossing, because they do very often have a lot of fog like that. They also did a lot of point-of-view camera work, where you would have the camera looking very much from a character's point of view and looking directly at another character for a conversation and that sort of thing. They had unusual perspectives, pointing from very low, looking up at someone, and a lot of unusual angles and interesting things that they were working with that I think were related to some of these ideas from the different directors and film styles that they were taking influence from, certainly from Hitchcock, and I think also from some of the Scandinavian work as well.
Yeah, absolutely. They were trying, you know, Alistair Reed was clearly trying all sorts of different camera sets up to reflect some of these influences. And as you say, these long episodes of people speaking directly into the camera and almost talking to us, which is slightly weird and strange to get used to at first.
It has a very experimental feel in the way that it's taking a bunch of different styles and taking these sort of science fiction story elements and mythological ideas and combining them together in a way that is quite unusual and rather strange.
Yep. There's a few special effects for a science fiction sort of based film, but not too many. There's a couple that work extremely well, which we'll perhaps come back to later on. We have to say that there's one or two slightly dodgy effects, which we'll also mention when we come to give our review and our recommendations. But on the whole, not many effects, but reasonably well done.
Fortunately, the effects that worked well are more prominent than the ones that didn't.
Yeah, it didn't, yes. I mean, you know, limited for its time and limited for budget, obviously. You know, how much of the budget they had to spend on the cast, we don't know, but and perhaps not too much left for the special effects, but not too bad. So should we get into the mystery of what the title means, Brian?
I think it's time for that.
So we're a bit puzzled by the title of Artemis 81, or is it Artemis 81? Certainly David Rudkin's own website suggests that it might be Artemis 81, which is the name of a distant star. Although despite that, if you listen to the commentary on the DVD we've been watching, even David Rudkin refers to it as Artemis 81 from time to time. And there's also some confusion on the DVD cover, because on the DVD cover, the number 81 is preceded by an apostrophe, suggesting that it's perhaps a shortened version of the year, because obviously this came out in 1981. So there's some confusion about where the title comes from and exactly what it stands for.
Yes, if you go by what David Rudkin, the writer, said, the title does come from the star Artemis 81, and the apostrophe suggesting the year 1981 is actually an error on the DVD cover. Now, whether it's pronounced Artemis 81 or Artemis 81 is a question that we don't have an answer for.
No, it's another one of the mysteries that we'll discover as we go along.
Yes, and it is suggested that maybe Artemis 81 is one of the stars seen from the alien planet. The alien planet has two suns. I'm not sure if Artemis 81 is a binary star or some other combination of star. I wasn't able to find that information. But perhaps the alien planet is in orbit of Artemis 81, or it may be another star, but also related to that.
We do get that impression that it might be one of the stars, that might be one of the links that brings some of these stories together.
Yeah, and there's also a planet and an asteroid with the name Artemis, so it's certainly a name that comes up quite a bit in a variety of ways.
And then also we've got specifically referenced during the film, we've got Artemis, the Greek goddess, and Artemis was the goddess of the hunt, but she multitasked. So she was also goddess of the moon, and she also covered fertility and childbirth as well. And there's an episode where the writer gets to discuss these various meanings of the Greek goddess with a student in a library, which gives us some of the clues as to what might be linking all this stuff together.
Yes, that was one of the few points where they actually make reference to Artemis during the film. There was another point where von Drachenfels describes a character trapped inside himself as being in the thrall of Artemis. So there's that idea as well. And there does seem to be an idea here of Artemis as a character of destruction, which is interesting having that as well as the ideas of fertility and childbirth.
And he wasn't, I mean, von Drachenfels doesn't seem to be directly talking about Gideon Harlux, the writer, when he says that. But it does seem to refer to this writer character who, as we've said, is very sort of obsessive and well organized and keeps himself to himself, and he's very contained and he's rather, I suppose, emotionally repressed. So whether he's in the thrall of old Artemis, I don't know, but it's another little clue that's tossed out and perhaps not fully explained.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff there, and hopefully by now you get the feeling that this is quite a complex story we're dealing with here, and something that is rather tricky to understand. And I think at that point we will leave off and talk more about Artemis 81, or indeed Artemis 81, in the next episode of British Invaders. So at that point, we will continue the story and give you a little bit more detail. We haven't given you much so far, but next time we'll talk a little bit more about what happens in the story.
And we'll try and answer some of the questions, although certainly there's a number of questions which we are still unable to answer. We'll look at some more bits and pieces about the production, and in particular, I think we're going to talk about some of the Hitchcock stuff, because that crops up quite a lot. We'll get to the bits that work well, and we'll mention one or two of the other bits that just left us completely baffled. So plenty to talk about in the next episode of British Invaders.
Yeah, it should be fun to get into some more of these things, for sure. You can reach us at britishinvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yep, thank you very much. Join us next time. This is Eamon from England saying goodbye.